I am a musician and electronic musician and what I would call a sound artist. And my kind of artistic background is in writing and poetry, but then also started playing improvised electronic music in my 20s. And so those practices kind of come together sometimes in my current work. But mostly I'm oriented towards concerts and sound installations. I grew up with a lot of music. My mother is a musician, and I played music like in band and in orchestra and stuff when I was younger. But I always liked writing, mostly because I really like reading. So I studied English literature in college, but I remember in high school, sort of about the midway through high school, I stopped playing in the orchestra. And so then I was really invested in like poetry and writing and English literature classes. And when I finished high school and went into college, a lot of the friends of mine who were also sort of studying English literature were also musicians. And so sort of part of my social and communal practice in college was this combination of being somebody who was studying English lit, but also interested in playing music. And I was in a band in college that was kind of like a large ensemble band where I played kind of improvised, where I mostly was just improvising. And not really well, I would say either. I was not a great musician in retrospect. Like, I was not a very good flute player, and that was the instrument I was playing in high school and middle school. So there was something about like music and improvisation and language that seemed to inform a lot of the way I thought about improvisation, which kind of kept, I think it was like, I was thinking, it was like informing the way I think about performing as an improviser, in the way that I had a certain kind of interest in, I don't even know, maybe non-syntactical music. Maybe that's the way to describe it, which is that I was interested in sounds that didn't necessarily make a lot of sense. I was interested in doing sort of musical things that didn't necessarily seem logical for the music that they were being used for, like meaning we were there was like a we had a couple like sort of pop type songs in our band, but I never was interested in playing any legible pop type rhythms or music or anything that made sense in that way. And that's kind of poetry I was interested in too, non-syntactical, abstract, a little abstract poetry. So yeah, and then that kind of merged together in my 20s and 30s, or most of my 20s. And again, it was like driven by the community that I was in. So I was in a community of poets, but also musicians who were improvisers or electronic musicians. So that practice really started to emerge in my 20s. And then when I went to Korea, I sort of discovered the instrument, the sort of electronic, no input type of feedback instrumentation that I got really interested in, and used as sort of like my primary instrument after that, when I was 27, I think. And actually in Korea, the person I worked the most with was also another person who wasn't a poet and studied English literature, but also was a musician and had done a lot of sort of free improvisation in their community in Portland, Oregon. But he had moved to Korea, and we met each other through the local Korean sort of electronic music improvisation scene, which was like seven people basically. The seven of us would hang out and play shows and had a little like Korean improv community. And when was that? In 2003. So that's kind of where it all came together. Like, Joe Foster, who was one I met in Korea, we had just a very similar approach to improvising that I think probably came from both our poetry, our interest in certain kinds of poetry, like abstract and lyrical at the same time. Like, there's something about the poetry that we were both interested in that lent itself to thinking about composition in that way. think that's it. I'm sorry, that took a long time to say.
No, it's great. I had a friend of mine who said that within the work of abstractness, that is also political. What do you think of that?
I think that abstraction or experimentation works in two ways that can be sort of politicized or political or have some kind of social justice component. It's not obviously that way, and there's a long, you have all of a art history and musical history to see how abstraction is usually framed. But for me, learning to express myself in a language that is highly, I don't know if it's highly legible, but it somehow does two things. It is both legible and illegible at the same time. It kind of like critiques structure whilst also making a different kind of structure at the same time. I think that's where it feels political, or that's the way I'm thinking about an abstraction in art, or in some certain improvised practices. It's like you're contending with a sort of status quo that is presented to you as the conditions of yourself as an artist in a certain world. And that world is a problem. The conditions that are set forth for you are usually oppressive, like being an Asian woman or having, class, race, gender, all of those things can be oppressive for certain people. So then the artwork somehow is going to be of you. It was going to articulate yourself as a certain individual that does not fit into the status quo, but it also has to provide a certain critique of that status quo. And how that works and how you do that in the artwork is not the same for anybody probably, but the intention to do so, the intention for the artwork that I make to kind of express that conflict between like finding something that feels like a true expression of myself whilst also critiquing and sort of dismantling a sort of status quo structure, like a social structure or a cultural structure, though it could also be a musical structure that I'm dismantling. But that those two things work together, and I do think that that can be like a particular political creative approach. Yeah, I might need that recording later because I feel like I've been in this dissertation work and people ask me about it and I have these articulations of it, and I really need to be able to review those later. I'm gonna ask for the recording so I can hear what I said so I
That's
can use it
good. That's
in my
good. You put it
dissertation.
very well said. Well said.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to hear you talking about your birth and upbringing background, but were you brought up in a multicultural society or more monoculture society? How was your childhood and teenagehood life, maybe adulthood life?
Yeah. So I was adopted into a large farm family where I had three white brothers. My parents were white, and then I had two non-white sisters, one Korean, and one First Nations Canadian. And so the upbringing in some ways was very different than the environment that we were being raised in, for two reasons. One, because there was this kind of transracial family that my parents had created. And then also because they were dairy farmers in a sort of rural suburb of Philadelphia, which is kind of something that doesn't really exist anymore, that there were a lot of farms that were like a half an hour from Philadelphia. Which are not the case anymore, just because the suburbs of Philadelphia have grown outwards. But my family had been there for several generations, and so they're both my mother's side and my father's side have been there for several generations. And my father's side were dairy farmers a couple generations back. So we grew up in a sort of rural upbringing, but was very close to a major cultural hub. So my mother's kind of cultural interest became the stuff that she exposed us to, And she was very oriented towards museums and movies and music and, you know, some writing. I don't think that was like her biggest interest in like literature. But she had a broad enough and kind of cultured enough background and interest that we were exposed to a lot of culture through her, just particularly going to museums and just kind of being encouraged in creative pursuits. But we were still on a dairy farm, so there's this combination of some of that creative possibility, but also just the regular kind of typical kind of conservative sort of leanings of a dairy farmer. And also the labor that is associated with being living on a dairy farm or living on a farm in general, and sort of growing up with that particular kind of approach to work.
In your upbringings, have you always thought about your identity? And then how does that feed into your creative practice?
I think that I couldn't remember it. I couldn't tell you exactly when this happened, but I feel like I knew early on, from the earliest time I can remember, that I was adopted. I don't, my family were not, it's not, they didn't try to give me a different story. Not that they really could, because however early it was that I recognized I did not look like my parents, would have been the moment when they would have to say, like, you were adopted. So I don't, I think that basic part of me trying to understand myself as different from my adoptive parents was there very early. But as far as even knowing what that really meant, or even coming into thinking about an Asian American identity, that's not something my family cultivated. They didn't like sort of tell me early on, like, you are an Asian American. You can explore your culture and your history and your background in this way. I think parents in the 70s, late 70s, who were adopting from other countries had been given the advice to assimilate their children, their adoptive children, to sort of this kind of like treat this child like any of your other, children. Treat them like they are no different from your other children. Which, is kind of a sweet way of helping to think about how to integrate the adoptive child into a family where you already have children that you've that were sort of your biological children. But when you add like a transracial component, the like looking back, that just is incredibly naive and sort of destructive to pretend as if your Asian child is the same as your white child, because nobody in the United States pretends that an Asian person is a white person, or a black person is an Asian person, or a white, like the racial history of the United States is such that like whether you believe that or not, whether you believe that you don't see color, everything in America is oriented around race. So, or it is now slash also about around class, but so that's not a great thing for parents to teach their children, I think, because it also confuses their understanding of their particular Asian identity, even if that identity is only skin deep, even if they don't think of themselves as having a strong connection to Korea or Japan or China, or the Philippines or wherever. There is still an aspect of understanding yourself as racialized within an American context that I think is really important to have. And I did not have that. And I didn't really think about it that much until maybe my mid, or no, my early 20s, or my just right as I was finishing college, undergrad. I was 21 or something. And I moved to Baltimore, and I had started thinking about Korean identity, and I was doing stuff online, researching online, because now, like, this is early 2000s, so finally the internet is like a thing that people have. So, as soon as the internet became a thing that you could use, you could start researching about these different Korean organizations that were gathering, these meetings. And then, between like 2001 and 2004, was a really important time to really think about the adoptee identity, and that resulted in me going to Korea for that year in 2004. and living there and meeting up with a lot of adoptees and kind of understanding myself from that perspective. And so, well, I guess I was 27 when I went to Korea. So then everything kind of after returning to Korea that first time has been oriented towards me understanding myself as a Korean adoptee, a Korean transracial and transnational adoptee, which does also kind of sit next to what it is to be Asian American. But my understanding of myself as Asian American is much more recent. I would say my first identity designation was like, I am a Korean adoptee. And then that was like most of my 20s and into my early 30s. And then somehow within the last, maybe the last decade, maybe even a little bit like from mid 30s till now. So, like, yeah, sometime in the last decade, that identity has broadened into an understanding of myself as a particular kind of Korean American. So not just a Korean adoptee as identity, but like I am a subset of Korean American that is the adoptee. So my sense of being sharing things or having a broader connection to Asian Americans more generally feels much stronger than it was in the past. I think that as far as its relationship to practice, I think no matter what a person believes is the influence of their sense of self on their work, everybody's work is influenced by their sense of self. Whether you have a racial identity, a gender identity, or whatever it is, a national or ethnic identity, I don't think art exists outside of the self, outside of one's conception of who they are and the thing in which they would like to make. And that is in part a sort of relationship between the self and how how you shape the external. So I do think that my identity has always played into the work I was making, whether I could understand it or see it or recognize it or not. And now in the later part of my practice, it really is more about making that an intentional content, or that the content itself, or making work that is actually about that specifically. But it's always been about that, even if it didn't look like it was about that. Like I can see that now, like in the last 20 years of making work, it's always that thing that was me figuring out something about my relationship to the world was always in the work. If like specifically making work that you feel is about something in particular, like meaning these projects that are about the adoption archives that I'm working with, I haven't used the word responsibility in that, though I guess that would be an interesting way to think about why I want to make that work. I do think that artwork, I do think that making art or having an art practice that sort of expresses the sort of practices of creating knowledge that you would have that would be different from other people because you're yourself and you have a system in which you create knowledge that is based on a lot of the particularities of how you view yourself in relation to the world. And so if we're thinking about art as a place in which you can see someone else's way of listening, someone else's way of looking, someone else's way of performing, then that becomes an important artifact in thinking about the world as having a lot of sort of radical difference or ways of being or ways of expressing or knowing yourself and knowing other things. And I do think that that's a really, that is like what I think is very important about what we would hope might become a way of being in relation to each other. Like I do think that artwork does help maybe one person to relate to another in a way that is not about them being the same, but about them understanding the way in which that other person moves through the world. So it's not necessarily like anything will make us all feel like we're the same, even though that is a bit of the logic that we have been living in, which is like finding ways for finding like a flag that we can all stand under and feel like we're the same, finding a leader that we can all believe in and feel like we're all the same in that belief. a god or a religion or a whatever, money. But I don't think we're all the same. I don't think that's the secret. The secret is not that we're all the same in a more generic way. I think that the secret is that we're all amazingly different in a way that makes like our collective kind of existence the same.
Yeah,
You know,
connected.
like something about sameness and difference is something that I've been thinking a lot about. And I do think like art enables the expression of the difference and not the expression of the sameness, but it can result in a feeling of like that you understand something now, or you're in a different relationship to something or someone, or
Yeah.
I think that's where I've arrived at that. I think that's still a thought in progress, but that's kind of where I'm at.
What do you think is your country or your countries, or does it even matter?
I don't know. I don't know even. I wouldn't say it doesn't matter, because there is still a sort of like social and cultural mechanism in the US that makes it such that it has to matter in a certain way, like for political reasons, for work, doing like activist work reasons. There's a mattering of needing to think of myself as a Korean. But culturally, I definitely am what, you know, I'm an American. I'm culturally an American. But my version of what that means is that I am, maybe it's sort of related to what I had just mentioned. It's like, it just means that like there's a certain understanding of difference that does not, cannot, or does not just like sort of synchronize or something with everybody else in that country. Like, I think that's what I don't exactly know how I would, I don't exactly know how to describe this feeling about what America is, but it is something about a difference that doesn't just result in a sameness. That stays a difference, but that does kind of form a kind of general understanding of what it means to have a sort of national boundary or something. I don't know. This question actually somebody asked me several years ago. In like I was doing some like anti-racist training, and we were doing our sort of end of the session follow-ups, and they and the moderator that was working with us had said something like, you should ask yourself the question of why you call yourself a Korean American. Like, and that's the question that you had asked too, like, why would you add the American? Why is using the Korean important? Why is it important that they're both there? And I don't know if I actually know the answer to that still yet, but I do know it has something to do with owning the part of my identity that is the origin of my birth, and also the thing in which, you know, becomes played out in a very different racial politics way in the United States, and the history of Korea in the United States, and the history of Korea in relationship to the rest of Asia. Korean War, the adoption practices, all that are very Korean. And then the American side has to be about just this is the cultural way in which I was raised. And so all of the American assumptions about the rest of the world have been put inside me from being raised that way, especially being raised that way by white Americans. So all of those things are very American, this kind of like the sort of first world arrogance and paternalistic relationship to Asia and, you know, various settler colonial moves since the forming of the United States and African enslavement. So all of those things are American. And so those parts I've been taught those things, and those things are in my personality from being raised in this country by white Americans.
Do you miss Korea?
I don't know if I would say that, because I don't sense a feeling. I don't have a feeling of it in the same way. I had only lived there for 1 year total of my 46 years, and I don't feel it the same way. I think a lot about I think a lot about how I felt in Korea at certain times when I was living there, and that feels like something I miss feeling. Like I miss feeling, which is a little bit like that adoption conference, but which is like I kind of miss feeling the that you could just disappear into a into a crowd, and have, you know,
Unless you talk.
the ability to just be invisible or move into a group of people where nobody looks at you in any particular way because you're all Koreans. Which is a little bit like this adoption conference where the whole hotel is filled with 300 Korean females, and you're not looking at yourself in any particular way in relation to that, because if anything, you're just noticing that we're all Koreans. I don't know. There's something nice about that. These questions, I mean, the conference was a conference about visibility and representation. That was the theme. And I was like, visibility and representation is great, but you can't take for granted how great invisibility is too, and how nice it is to not have to think of yourself in a particular way every time you enter a room that's, you know, mostly not Asian.
Is there any difference between when you make visual work and more abstract sound making?
I do think that's why I've put them all together now, because there's just a way of talking about a subject that's you can't really easily do in the audio work that I'm interested in. Though I have been doing audio work that's more like an essay, and that opens up the possibility to say things just using your voice or other people's voices inside the audio piece itself. And I do use a lot of field recordings of Korea that at least signal that the audio is referencing Korea or Asia. So sometimes now these days, the audio can also reinforce some of the ideas, but it doesn't. I mean, I haven't done a ton of ones where I'm kind of speaking almost like a lecture, but I could see myself doing some of that and using my voice in order to sort of put very specific content inside a musical piece that would be still performed like a regular concert, but would have sections that are really spoken. Sort of a, there's a great artist, Jerome Ellis, who has a piece that is kind of like a sound essay or a performance lecture, where there's a lot of conceptual material that he speaks in the music, but the music is also, you know, the whole thing reads as like a musical piece, even though there's sections that are like musings and something that you would find in an essay. And he has a stutter, so a lot of the importance of the text is his way of moving through language and music through this, or language and sound through his particular vocal situation or vocal condition. So it kind of all works together in a really nice way. Like the thing he's trying to demonstrate is thinking about the temporality of stutter, and he does so by making a musical piece and using his voice to kind of reference what's happening. And that's very effective, you know.
What are you working on recently?
What am I working on?
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on my dissertation project, which is a sort of multimodal kind of exploration of sort of performative archive making, maybe. I don't. I'm actually working on trying to figure out how to describe it. Is really what I'm trying to do, trying to write about it and trying to come up with a way to describe it. But it's coming from my collaboration with Mary Kim, who I probably told you about, and we have been working on developing a piece together. And that piece is sort of asking questions of the archive and where and how knowledge is produced through the archive, and then sort of what happens when you produce your own archive in the present, and what knowledge is produced when you do that. Knowledge is knowledge about like kinship, about ideas of belonging, about how our identities are sort of co-created, things like that. I think that's a pretty good description.
Do you feel nostalgic about Korea?
No, I think you did. You ask me that last time. You may have.
Oh, I
I
asked
think you may
more.
have.
Okay.
I don't have any. Oh yeah, because I had said like it's hard for me to feel any nostalgia for a place that I haven't had like formative childhood experiences at. But I have nostalgia for the time when I went as an adult. Like I have a not it's not a nostalgia, but it's sort of like the same desire that had brought me there in the beginning is still like the same desire that I have for like maybe going back to Korea and being in Korea again. But it's not like a nostalgia. I think it's just more like a, I don't know, something, it's just something I want to do again before too long.
Where is your home?
I think my home is wherever I am.
That's nice.
Yeah, I don't think it, I can't locate it anywhere else. It's always in the process of being in a place where you're sort of making your community and making your kinship.
Do you think that affects to the way we create works?
I think it kind of does since, and you're similar in this way, like
Very.
our work is really site oriented and it uses a site to point to things that are not in that site, but also to things that are sort of essential to it, like communities or visitors or friends or collaborators or improvisers who work with us. So I don't know, something about the site specificity is also about making home wherever you are.
Belong to is where we are. I don't belong here. I feel quite sad. You know, that kind of thing. Do you have that, or you're kind of more objective about it? And do you think that reflects upon your work?
I do think, I think, I mean, that's like a very key word there, belonging. That is one of the definitions that I'm trying to explore with Mary Kim in terms of like sort of developing new knowledge about what it means to belong. I don't think it's as easy as thinking of myself as not belonging, sort of, you know, my upbringing or in other circles that I might have been in growing up or where I ended up in my life now. I think it's more complex than saying like, oh, I didn't belong in those spaces because I was the only non-white person or something. I don't know if I've sort of sorted out how to describe it yet. I guess in another way, okay, so in another way, I don't necessarily have a problem with not belonging. Maybe that's the way to say it. Sometimes it's alienating and other times it isn't. Sometimes it can be used to sort of create some new possibility. Sometimes it closes down possibilities. I suppose it's more complex than just saying that I have or that I am working with any pervasive sense of not belonging. Yeah, because I don't think that comes to mind as much. Like maybe I feel like I don't belong anywhere, and so therefore I belong anywhere I want to be, or maybe there's something about that word.
Do you think that strength actually comes from the fact that kind of never belonged to it anyway? So,
I think I'm
if you
thinking
grow up
about,
in, yeah.
a sort of negative assertion. Like there's a book that I was reading from a professor at Brown who's writing about these ideas of inauthenticity or unbelonging, like against like how you would then sort of like position. I'm studying like Mexican art and culture. So it'd be like how you might position yourself as not belonging to a predominant view of Mexican artists and cultural producers. That there is a little bit of a, sometimes in order for things to be more, I mean, it's just like punk rock culture. So in order for things to feel more liberatory, it actually is not belonging. It's a refusal to belong,
That
something
sounds,
like that.
yeah, it's interesting.
So not belonging as a kind of protest or resistance.
Are you still curious about your biological family?
I think I'm curious, but don't feel any urgency. I mean, over the last several years, when I've been doing all this research, there were moments when I sort of took a little step further along to sort of get more information or to do something to sort of start to think about initiating a search. And when I went to this conference, I learned about other things to do and other ways to find out information. And I wouldn't say that I'm not curious. And I might sort of send in some forms, and maybe see if I can get some more information. But I really don't feel any urgency about it. I really don't feel like there's some part of me that won't be resolved if I don't find out who they are. There's something that will be added to my life if I find out. It just doesn't, I think it's maybe it's my age or just the kind of personal work that I have been doing to try to come to terms with things like around those questions of belonging and family and kinship. Yeah, I don't feel, I just, it doesn't sit in, for a lot of adoptees, that question of where they came from really does, it just sort of preoccupies their life in a way that really is really impactful on their mental health and just on their day-to-day. And I don't think I've ever really felt that intensity around that question. And even now, I don't really feel that. And I can only attribute it to like having really shifted my definition of family or something. There's something, I must have shifted it in such a way that I really don't think of family in any traditional sense of birth parent, adopted parent, any of those things are sort of been altered. So I don't, yeah, I don't, I really don't feel that urgency. I mean, I've been thinking about it a lot, and I'm always surprised that I haven't felt that urgency. It's never preoccupied me in this in that way. So, I
So,
mean, that could go back to that, like, you're alone, and home is where you are anyways, and you don't belong anyway, so that's fine. You're operating from that position of being on the margin.
On the contrary, I'm so interested in it. Maybe you should tell me some link how I look for my ancestors.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, yours might be, mine is all through adoption bureaucracy, so that would be very different than for you. I'm sure there are family records though for your father's family. But also there would be something in Korea for his Korean family and your Korean family there. Like they have that system called the Hojuk. I mean, this would probably lead you to some of this if you could figure out how to get your hands on. I think it's called a Hojukdun. It's like a family registry. It's like where everybody, it's like a census where everybody born, whose fathers, mothers, etc., is taken down and put into the sort of, it's like your social security number or your birth certificate or something. So somewhere in Korea, if it hasn't been destroyed, which is possible that it has, there is some Hojuk document that outlines your father, his parents, his children. Well, maybe not his children. He had his, wait, were you born in Korea or were you born in Japan?
Japan.
You didn't have any siblings born in Korea, right? Just,
No,
do
I'm.
you have siblings though, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So my dad had siblings, half born in Korea, the rest born in Japan. But then I don't even know my grandma's real name because
She
they have
changed.
Japanese names, and then
Yeah,
never
yeah.
questioned it. But
That might
that's
be the difficult part of that time period when all the
yeah.
Koreans had to take Japanese names until the Japanese realized that they didn't want Koreans to be Japanese.
But such a
They,
complicated country,
it's
Korea.
so, it's,
I don't know why
yeah, Japan
people
is a
don't.
lot.
I mean,
A lot going on.
it's serious there.
I don't know.